Right, good afternoon to you. I hope you're well. It's 5 p.m. That is British summer time here in Manchester. It's April 24th, 2019. Bad weather system coming in over South Manchester. Thunderstorms promised this evening after what has been an amazing week or so of weather. I'm Richie Allen. This is the Richie Allen Show, of course, broadcasting right now on Fab Radio 2 here in this great city. Tune in Radio TriggerWarning.tv and, of course, my own website, RichieAllen.co.uk. Not going to the news at the top of the hour because I want to talk a little bit about the funeral of Lyra McKee, which took place this afternoon, covered widely on UK television news media. I want to talk a little bit about that and more besides as well. I've got two terrific guests lined up for you this Wednesday. It is Wednesday, April 24th, that's right. Two great guests lined up for you. As usual, you can join in the programme by tweeting me. You know the Twitter handle by now. Let's do it.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, everybody's very excited about the Manchester Derby this evening at Old Trafford at 8 p.m. United and City. I've got 2 hours of, I think, far more interesting stuff than football for you. Coming up this hour, I'll be joined by the meteorologist, the scientist, Piers Corbyn. Piers has been talking, he's been speaking out about the campaign group Extinction Rebellion and about the promotion of young Greta Thunberg, the Swedish schoolgirl. He's had a lot to say, has Piers. He joins me this hour, in fact in about 20 minutes time, to talk about this. This protest continues in London. It's been there now for over a week. Piers Corbyn this hour. And coming up in the second hour, an old friend of mine. It's been about 2 years since he was on the programme. G. Edward Griffin. Ed is on the show, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve, and of course, Word Without Cancer. He's also these days the chairman of the Red Pill Expo. G. Edward Griffin, my old pal Ed, joins the programme in the second hour. Right, yeah. Yeah, bad weather. I think it's beginning to chuck it down, as my Mancunian brethren and sistren might say. Bad weather forecast after, as I said, what has been a pretty decent week, hasn't it? We had a lovely bank holiday weekend, so we did. Very timely, that very good weather as well, in terms of the newsworthiness of it. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a chestnut. Is it a chestnut with me? Is it something I harp on a bit about too much? Maybe I do. Maybe I can't miss an opportunity to talk sometimes about how I view the country's media, the international media, and how it operates. The BBC is reporting this afternoon that a priest received a standing ovation at the funeral of Lyra McKee because he asked mourners gathered there why it took her death to unite them. And he was speaking about the political parties, political leaders of the UK and Ireland, Northern Ireland and Ireland, were front and centre. And he addressed them and he said, why did it take her death to unite them? We might get a snip of it in a minute. In fact, we will. So there was a vigil in Derry following her death, of course. We talked about that briefly with Tony Gosling last night. And she had a funeral today at St. Anne's Cathedral in Belfast. And there, Father Martin McGill spoke out. We'll hear that in a second. The young journalist was shot dead in Derry on Thursday. She had been observing rioting in the Creggan area of Derry. The new IRA has claimed, allegedly, that its members fired the shot that killed her. Anyway, Father Martin McGill, Catholic priest in Belfast today. Here he is addressing the mourners, but specifically the politicians who were in the front couple of rows.
Since Thursday night, we have seen the coming together of so many people in various places and the unifying of the community against violence. I commend our political leaders for standing together in Craigan on Good Friday. I am, however, left with a question. Why in God's name does it take the death of a 29-year-old woman with her whole life in front of her
Yeah, so they're standing and cheering and clapping. Not cheering, clapping. And at the very end, the politicians rose to their feet and clapped as well. I think the priest was very much aware of the international media attendance today. Then I am a cynic.
The death of a 29-year-old woman with her whole life in front of her to get to this point.
To what point exactly? I don't know what point he's referring to. The politicians he's looking at, people like the leaders of the DUP, Arlene Foster and Mary Lou McDonald, these people meet pretty regularly. I know he's referring to the fact that devolved government, that Stormont hasn't sat for the best part of 2 years and all of that. Anyway, there you go. So the funeral began at 1 o'clock today. What funeral ever began at 1 o'clock in the afternoon? Just wondering. Was it timed for the national 1 p.m. news bulletins by any chance? You can bet your backside it was. Because no funeral that I've ever attended in Ireland, either north or south, has ever started at one. Lyra McKee. Did you ever hear of Lyra McKee before last Thursday? You might have, but the vast majority of people didn't hear of her. She's not a Grammy-winning Irish rock star. She wasn't a former Prime Minister. She wasn't an Oscar-winning actress. And she wasn't a famous sportswoman. So why did the UK's 24-hour news channels, why did they decamp to Belfast to cover the entire Requiem Mass uninterrupted? Why did they do that? Anyone asking that question today, do you think? Are you asking that question? Do you not care? Why was the schedule cleared for the afternoon to bring you uninterrupted coverage of a mass with a lot of interviews with mourners before and after? Why? Now, I don't owe Lyra McKee anything, so I'm not going to apologise for any offence that I might cause in the next couple of minutes. It's rotten that a young woman, who by all accounts was a pretty decent writer, I believe, written a couple of books. It's rotten that she was killed last week in Derry. Rotten, isn't it? It must be rotten for her family, her parents and her grandparents, because it's an abomination when somebody as young as that dies before their parents. It's a dreadful thing. Not experienced it, so I can only imagine it. So the media is not asking any questions of anyone as usual. What the media has done, and it is a collective, by the way, they all do the same thing. Do you ever wonder why? Has anybody wondered why the 24-hour news channels do the same things in the same order? And they have correspondents who look exactly the same and sound exactly the same. What the media did collectively was staged an event. 1 o'clock, remember. Perfectly, you know, bleeding into the 1 o'clock news bulletins on Sky, on the BBC and ITV's news, which starts a bit later. An event where the dead woman, Lyra McKee, and her family are used as props. No questions. Why no questions of the police service in Northern Ireland, the PSNI? Why was this young woman standing at a police line if there were known dissidents in the area with guns and with weapons? Why? Why wasn't she wearing a flak jacket? It's not unheard of for journalists to get access. But a journalist like Lyra McKee, very little known journalist, what was she doing there? Why was she on the police line? If there was genuine fear that dissidents were operating in that area in Creggan and that they had live ammunition, why? Why, as Tony Gosling pointed out on this programme last night, why after the police found nothing in preliminary searches of houses, why did they continue to smash down doors and break windows, inflaming a situation? Why? Why did they do that? Who are the real IRA? I mean, really, who are they? Out of nowhere, they've materialised, right? Is it incredible timing, perhaps? Because Republicans are mystified. Nobody knows them. Nor does it seem, does anybody support them? Who are these people? Why would they fire on a police line? Where else in the world do folks fire at the police and get away with it? Why wasn't the shooter or shooters engaged and either killed or captured? Well, you might say, Richie, they took a very precautious approach, maybe. Maybe they didn't want innocent bystanders to be caught up in the shootout. Maybe. But I've never known any police force ever to not surround the entire area, get everybody back out, all those not concerned with it, and then try to apprehend or close in on those who fired the shots. So those are some very serious questions right there. I won't read them again, but they are not being asked on the UK television channels today, nor are broadsheet journalists asking these questions. They're being ignored by the daytime soap opera that is the media in the 21st century. We have news readers speaking in sombre tones, handing over to their correspondents in Belfast, speaking in very quiet and sombre tones, like actors and actresses. Presenters, we're live to Derry now for more reaction. Joanne Smith knew Lyra and all of that. And let's go now and speak to our correspondent. And speaking in very hushed tones, like Kay Burley today.
Let's speak to our IR correspondent, Stephen Murphy, who's joining us now. Hello to you, Stephen. It was a very emotional service, wasn't it?
It really was, Kay. So powerful, so moving in so many ways. It was a very difficult day, I think it's worth remembering as well, for many of the people here. Ryder Square, just behind me, it's just opposite.
This is like the aftermath of a soccer match now. It's like going to a football ground 25 minutes after the event, after the game, and you're getting a running commentary on what happened. Well, it was a 3-3 draw, loads of drama, last-minute goal, sending off, unbelievable. And what this guy does, and they've done this all afternoon since the coverage ended, is get correspondents telling us what happened at the funeral. This is news in the 21st century. Listen to this guy.
Opposite. From the cathedral just half an hour ago, 45 minutes ago, this whole area behind me was packed with hundreds and hundreds of people from every part of Northern Ireland, from every part of the political spectrum in Northern Ireland, people who knew Lyra very well, either through work or through her campaigning for the LGBT community, or people who didn't know her at all and were just extremely moved by her story and by the circumstances in which her life was snuffed out last Thursday in Derry. They came far and wide, and it was, as you said, a very, very emotional occasion from the moment her coffin stopped here. The hearse stopped outside the cathedral. The coffin was brought out. A spontaneous round of applause broke.
The coffin coming out, applause, this young life and all of that. Politicians, her friends.
Broke out.
Incredible, isn't it?
Broke out. I think you just heard there some snippets from some of the themes, some of the speakers inside the cathedral. We heard from Stephen Lusty, a close friend. He gave a very heartfelt and at times a very humorous, a very personalised account of it.
Heartfelt and humorous and personalised account and all of that. What the fuck is that? Is that journalism, is it? Is it pathos? We must all feel sad at the death of this young woman. We must stand up against those who seek to divide us. And why were UK and Irish political leaders sitting in the front row? Why? Didn't she have friends, neighbours, colleagues, schoolmates, maybe, that would have been sitting in the front row? maybe the political leaders were sitting in the front two or three rows. Maybe it was so that the cameras could capture them. That's it. That's probably it. And the mass. Wow. I couldn't help but think all afternoon, the timing of this is uncanny. Who would benefit most from an increase in tension among nationalist and loyalist communities in the north? Who? It's been drummed into us time and time again. We're being told, even this week we're being told again, that there has to be a customs union effectively keeping the UK in the EU to avoid a return to hostilities in the north. I can't help thinking that's significant, you know. We can't have a hard border between the UK and Ireland. There can't be a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland because we don't want to return to the old days. Right? It's pretty strange, isn't it? We'll come back to that in a minute. Here's Sky's Northern Ireland editor, David Blevins. This is very telling commentary. Now, Kay Burley is handing over to this guy. These are the people who are charged with the responsibility of asking questions of elected officials, of asking questions of the police service in Northern Ireland, of really asking uncomfortable questions, hard questions, to try and find out what's happened. That's their job. Are they doing it? No, they're doing this.
I think, Kay, what strikes me most today is the diverse nature of this congregation. Protestant, Catholic, Unionist, Nationalist, British, Irish, young, old, gay, straight. It really reflects the values of Lyra McKee. She was a young woman who described herself as a child of the ceasefires. She had aspirations of a Northern Ireland that was different, one that had changed, become more normal. And she was disappointed that her hopes of a lasting peace had not yet become reality.
She was 29 years old. And she was disappointed that her hopes of a lasting peace were disappointed. Northern Ireland is unrecognisable in 2019 compared to the early 1990s, compared to the 1980s or the 1970s. What is he talking about? They're creating a myth around this woman that they've martyred. This woman that nobody had ever heard of. Talking about diversity, young, old, gay, straight, diversity of people at the funeral of this woman who didn't get to realise her ambition that lasting peace would come to Northern Ireland. We've had lasting peace in Northern Ireland for 20 years now. What is this?
But no one could ever have imagined that this beautiful, vibrant, talented young woman would have her life so cruelly cut short by a dissident Republican bullet. And the nature of this entire service today, I think, has been about celebrating all that was good about Lyra McKee's life.
But what was good about Lyra McKee's life? What exactly? What do these correspondents know about this young woman? She was a writer. Starting out, really, I know she'd won some Young Journalism Award given by Sky back in the noughties and that, and she'd written for a few publications, but she was pretty much an unknown. And they're eulogising this woman and creating a fictional narrative around her to sell this story, to invest you in the drama. This is bullshit, this. It's his job to find out why she was killed. What was she doing there? Why wasn't she wearing a flak jacket? Where are the people who shot her? Why weren't they arrested, apprehended, or why weren't they fired upon? What's going on?
His life, reflecting on her family's desire for people to adopt her philosophy and to address...
What philosophy? Who is this woman? Do you understand what I'm getting? Am I driving you mad or am I driving myself mad? This is crap, isn't it? And it's all we have. This is crap by David Blevins, the long-time Sky News Northern Ireland correspondent. Rubbish.
Hatred and intolerance with love and understanding,
yeah,
and kindness.
Meet hatred and intolerance with love and understanding and with kindness. Blah, 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 blah. What a crock of shit that is. Martyring a previously anonymous young journalist, building a fictional narrative around her values, her aspirations for Northern Ireland. Disappointed she was that her hopes of a lasting peace hadn't been imagined. What a lie. There has been peace. Are there dickhead loyalists and dickhead Republicans who will never accept peace? Yes, I'm sure there are, but they're a tiny minority and they have no support. Whose interest is it in that there is tension in Northern Ireland? That's the question that should be being posed by the likes of David Blevins. And since the funeral, on the hour, every hour. Here's a little bit more from Blevins. He's just about to announce that the PSNI Chief Constable George Hamilton is going to address the assembled media after the funeral. Listen to this.
So I will pause in a moment to allow the Chief Constable to speak. We're not quite sure what he's going to say today, whether he's going to talk about the investigation or something else, but I suspect he may also reflect on the diversity of this congregation and on the nature of this event and the desire that people here have.
The diversity of the congregation and the nature of this event. It has become an event because they have turned it into an event. A state funeral attended by every major political leader in the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland. Covered uninterrupted, a requiem mass on Sky News. Do you know what it is? It's a ritual sacrifice. If it is possible to sacrifice somebody who's already dead. Isn't that extraordinary? Shall we get our first guest on the line, shall we, and leave that one alone? Let's do that. He's an extraordinary man, is Piers Corbyn. He's an incredibly intelligent man whom I've invited him on this program several times in the past to give a counterpoint, to give a different point of view on the CO2 carbon dioxide is driving climate change narrative. We've been stunned, I think it's fair to say, over the last week or so to see the Extinction Rebellion movement, the growth of it, the arrival in the country of the Swedish sensation Greta Thunberg, this 16-year-old child who's met with most of the world's most important leaders and the Pope to tell them that there must be action taken on climate change now. Some of you have been astonished at the kid glove treatment of these protesters in London as they've brought the city, large parts of it, to a standstill, as they've caused loss of earnings to businesses in London, great and increasingly small businesses. Well, Piers Corbyn, the meteorologist, the scientist, the academic, the former politician, has been asking questions about this group and about Greta Thunberg. And Piers has been making the national press today over comments that he made about Thunberg in particular. Delighted to welcome him back to the programme. Piers, welcome back. You join
Manchester. How'd you do?
I'm very well. You join Manchester just as it's begun to thunder and lightning. Massive storm up here, which of course you knew about anyway, being that great meteorologist. Now, some of my listeners, not me, but some of my listeners are saying, you went a bit hard there on Greta Thunberg, calling her ignorant and saying that she was basically brainwashed and she was being manipulated by people maybe behind the scenes, maybe more hidden. What's going on? Why did you use language like that? You're obviously very frustrated with the coverage of this group.
She is ignorant, as are most of those people in Extinction Rebellion, as it called itself. Is she brainwashed? Yes, I would say so. As are many of these other people, brainwashed because they've got a fanatical belief in something which is completely false, and that is the hallmark of brainwashing, which has been used by dictatorships for some hundreds of years. And we have a movement before us which actually is orchestrated by the forces that want globalization and are behind super corporations and so forth.
We'll talk about that in a second,
Piers. It's not science at all. It's counter-science.
Now, we'll talk about those that you believe are behind it in a minute. I'm fascinated about this. We have gotten into this, you and I, before. Piers is going to stay with us till 6 o'clock, by the way, so we've got plenty of time to chat about this. Loads of comments on it already. But before we do, I sometimes, like other independent radio producers, get criticised for not getting stuck into people like you. I can't pretend, well, I can't pretend to be objective because I'm not. I agree with you, and I think my listeners know that.
Yeah,
right,
of course,
but,
yeah.
But if I'll be the devil's advocate for a minute, the likes of Greta Thunberg and her pals will say, Piers, how in the name of God could we be able, how could we understand or how could we know who to believe? Yes, you are, as you pointed out on social media, and you're right to do it. You are qualified, eminently qualified to talk about this. Nobody can deny your academic qualifications. But your opponents will say, I can point to a dozen or two dozen or three dozen academics in the UK who say, listen, CO2 is causing catastrophic climate change and it is going to be irreversible in the next few years if we don't do something about it. So she will say, why should I believe you and not believe them?
Well, the reason is that there's no evidence at all for man-made climate change. These academics who say these things are in the pay of the the gravy train which promotes man-made climate change, and there is not a single scientific paper in the world which says and shows with real data that carbon dioxide causes changes in climate. What we actually have is the fact that carbon dioxide is an effect, not a cause, of changes in climate. When the sea warms up, it emits carbon dioxide, and when it cools down, it absorbs it. And there's a lag in time, and the reason for the increase of carbon dioxide now is an increased equilibrium level between the atmosphere and the sea, and that is because it was an after effect of the medieval warm period. We've challenged the BBC again in a letter we delivered on Easter Monday to produce one scientific paper which is peer-reviewed and shows using real data evidence that carbon dioxide controls climate. Now, we know there is no such thing. And the people that preach these lies also know there's no such thing. So they've refused to turn up in public. The reason why we have this fronted by this schoolgirl is because there's no academic in the world who's prepared to come forward and be honest about what is going on.
Now, on that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change supposed to be a group of 1,300 plus independent scientific experts from around the world.
Well, it's nothing of the sort. It's a government, it's appointed by governments around the world. And it has a few token scientists and it expels token scientists or actual scientists it doesn't agree with. It's not a scientific body. It's not a peer-reviewed body. It's a government-appointed body to promote a certain narrative. And these reports you read are edited versions of some things put together partly by scientists. They're edited versions, I stress. All these so-called executive summaries are not written by scientists, many of whom would probably be ashamed to admit to them. But, of course, they're paid. I mean, I know people in the industry who say, well, Piers, you may well be right, but I have mouths to feed. I mean, we have now a situation.
Is that true, by the way? Sorry to
state
interrupt you.
Control,
yeah.
Corporate state control of academia.
I was just going to ask you.
It is very fearsome. It is very fearsome, and we have to combat it. And we are a tiny, tiny voice, but we are getting some people listening to us in Extinction Rebellion. When we gave out leaflets outside Friends Meeting House, we got a fair reception, you know, about a third of people took leaflets, which is quite interesting.
That's encouraging, that.
Some people were violent towards us and tried to grab our banner and so forth, but the majority of them were basically just misled by their parents or the BBC, and we're turning up to hear Greta Thunberg.
Slogans, yeah, that does bother me. When some of the commercial radio and television stations in this country have interviewed some of the protesters, they don't actually ask them any detailed questions or any in-depth questions, which is a bit of a... Can I just take you up on something? Sorry that people were violent towards you. That's disgraceful. Let me put this to you. You mentioned a second ago that within the industry, people have privately disclosed to you, and by people we mean academics, that They would speak up, but they can't because...
Well, I don't know if they would or wouldn't.
But they've got mouths to feed.
They can't, whatever, you know. You see, they can't give me an argument in favour of the stuff. I mean, there isn't. If you read these IPCC reports, they never have a comparison of carbon dioxide and temperatures. They just say CO2 is dangerous and it's going up, therefore we have to do something. If you look at graphs of CO2 and temperatures, you can see in the last 100 years, CO2 has been rising continuously under their measures, and temperatures of the world have been fluctuating. So sometimes they move together and sometimes they move in opposite directions. So there's no way you can use any graph at all, anywhere in the last 100 years, 1,000 years, or 10,000 years, or million years, to argue that CO2 controls climate. What you can do is look on timescales of about 500 years and you can see that climate controls CO2.
They love, they talk all the time about 150 years. Let me ask you this, and don't jump down my throat now, my friend, until I...
No, carry on,
Piers Corbyn is our guest, by the way, Weather Action. I'm going to put a link up to Weather Action, and I would ask you to support Piers Corbyn, by the way, because this is very serious. If you can find it within yourself to support and subscribe to Weather Action, do that. Because people like Piers Corbyn depend on independent donations and support. He can't do what he does, and he's a very, very lone voice in this struggle to get this information out there. We'll get on to that in a minute, by the way.
Well, it's good of you to say that. But we've got a little group now called Scientists for Truth, but we've got completely, absolutely no money. So, you know, you can go onto our website, weatheraction.com, and either buy forecasts, or you can just donate straight away to Scientists for Truth.
We'll do that. I mean, the price of a cup of coffee, if enough people did it, I totally endorse
indeed,
that.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
For your thousands of listeners, I'm sure that you've got, Richie.
Yeah, and like, sadly...
Well,
like,
you have, actually, haven't you?
It's pretty good, yeah, but sadly, most of us, like ourselves, most people are broke these days. But look, I do endorse what you do, Piers. I have no compunction about saying that. I totally endorse, and I recommend that if people can support you, they do. So let me put it to you then, in the absence, and this is the sickening thing, because I've invited you on before, and I've invited the Greens on, I've invited Friends of the Earth, I've invited academics on, and they've just said no, or they've ignored me. So let me put this to you in their absence. Yeah. They say that they can prove, and they have proved, that our modern civilization and the demands of our increased population growth have meant that the industrial activity over the last 150 years has definitely raised carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. They say from 280 parts per million to 400 parts per million. They say this is a fact. They can prove it. And they say this is having an effect. That it's patently obvious that it must be having an effect, and that climate deniers such as yourselves are burying your head in the sand. We must be having an effect. From 280 parts per million to 400 parts per million, it's got to be having some effect on weather and on climate. That's what they say.
Well, you know, you might as well say that the increased number of people watching television has had an increase, an effect on something. It's a complete nonsense. Carbon dioxide levels have gone up. They probably haven't gone up as much as they say, because those measurements in the past are not that accurate. They have fluctuated a lot in the last 100 or 200 years, and actual physical measurements rather than estimates from ice cores. The ice cores, of course, smooth things out, so you don't see decadal changes, for example. No, there's no evidence that the carbon dioxide levels are controlling climate, because if you look on longer time scales, you can see the opposite is true, namely the CO2 levels go up after temperatures have gone up at the ends of ice ages, for example. The physics of their claims are also complete nonsense. They contradict the first and second laws of thermodynamics, for example. Their circulation models predicted that there should be a warm spot above the equatorial regions After 10 years of increased CO2. So they said this in 2000. In 2010, they had a look, and they have to look all the time, and there's not a warm spot, there's a cold spot. So the opposite to their theory is actually being carried out. We have explanations of all this because they haven't applied what we would call non-stationary thermodynamics to looking at this stuff. They're using Mickey Mouse ideas and they get Mickey Mouse results, but the whole basis of their theory is incorrect. You see, if some theory produces predictions and those predictions fail, then there's something wrong with the theory. However, what they've done is they've decided to change the facts, and they're now modifying world temperatures on an industrial scale, as Christopher Booker has pointed out on a number of occasions in the Daily Telegraph. Like NOAA, for example, or NASA, one of the two, the American ones, that took some Icelandic data and just changed it, and that then put it into some world data set to get an average. I mean, this is what is going on. It is fraud, complete, utter, absolute fraud. And it is driven by the biggest financial capitalist interest. This movement is in no way anti-capitalist. They might think they are or feel they are, but it's completely not the case. What it appears to be now, I think, is that, the reason for it is twofold. One is it makes money for the big oil companies.
How does it do that? How does it make money for the big oil companies?
Because the whole climate change story enables them and governments to put up oil prices. Because the agreements for it by the oil companies state on the BP website, we support measures against carbon dioxide so long as there is a uniform price for carbon across the board, which means that the sale price of gasoline has to go up so that it's worth a farmer burning food, i.e. selling maize to burn as biofuels rather than sell it to the public. So he's got to be paid more than he would be selling it to as for food. So that automatically is a built-in increase in oil price. And what the oil companies pay for that is, if you like, a loss of about 2% of world energy production. But in exchange for that, they double the profits on 98%. So it's a complete no-brainer. So they're 110% behind this delusional nonsense.
But oil, oil is down, isn't it? The price of oil in the last couple of years has been fluctuating.
That is true. But because the OPEC is not all on board with everything, because Saudi Arabia's been trying to bankrupt Russia and so forth.
And Venezuela.
The general drift of the climate change story is to increase oil prices and increase profits of oil companies.
Well, it's funny you say that. So, again, sorry to interrupt you. It's funny you said, I think you're onto something there. Or the price of oil is low, and while it's, I think, targeting Russia, I think you're right, it's certainly targeting targeting Venezuela. There's also something very important to mention in this. The price at the pump is going up increasingly. And that's important,
absolutely. Now, but there's a second thing, a bigger dimension going on right now, which is, if you read the economic press in particular, the World Economic Forum, and I'm just looking for my notes on this. Here we are. The World Economic Forum has got a green investment report where they're talking about £700 billion is needed to save the planet, basically. And their executive summary is a complete pack of lies, but you know, whatever. It's a threat, you see. And they're talking about unlocking assets in the biggest 71 companies around the world in order to have investment, massive investment in green technology. Now, There may be a need for some investment in green technology, but this type of massive spend, I would suggest, has got a hidden agenda. I mean, they always want massive spends on everything because they skim off a substantial bit when any money moves about. So that is one thing. But the second thing is it may be an underhand way of getting their hands on various portfolios for pension funds, for example, and basically robbing pension funds to avert the coming banking crisis, which we're reliably informed is on the way by many, many people. Now, last time there was a big super duper world scare about climate was around 2008, just before that banking crash. So it seems to me it's highly likely that this sort of nonsense and this orchestrated brainwashing is actually part of robbing you and me if you've got any money in a pension fund.
This is really interesting stuff. We're talking about bail-ins there to offset the effects of climate
bail-ins,
change.
Exactly.
Let me read a couple of comments. Folks, go to weatheraction.com and if you don't have any money, sign up there and join the website anyway. If you can support initiatives like that, and Piers talked about the Scientists for Truth earlier on, do support it if you can. It's very important. The independent media doesn't have any other way of continuing.
That's right.
It's a fact. By the way, I want to give a big shout out to two people here. Mark Windows and Sandy Adams have done extraordinary work on revealing this agenda and how it permeates, how it infiltrates local authorities right across the UK and what it means for us. You know, it's a control agenda as well. You know, it segues into so many different things, gentrification as well, all sorts of stuff, really important. Piers, I'm going to read a couple of tweets.
Yeah,
Ruth is in Australia listening. It's in the very small hours of the morning there. Friend of ours, Ruth says, Richie, climate change is about joining nation states together. There are no borders when it comes to climate change. Once we have nation states joined together, we have global governance, one world government and one world religion. And you know what that makes me think of, Piers? I think that's an excellent comment, an excellent comment by her, because last year, Richard Haass, who heads up the round table group, the Council on Foreign Relations, very important Rockefeller group, of course, in New York, that has a lot to do, a big say in US government policy. Richard Haass says there can no longer be borders. He said that if a country is doing something within its borders that might cause harm to the climate, we, as the rest of the world, he said, should have the right to go in there and get stuck in. He said we shouldn't have to respect sovereign borders if a country is doing something, and he used the example of harming the climate. Is this partly about transforming society, Piers?
Oh, I think it is, very definitely. You see, this brainwashing emanates, as I said, from the highest levels. It's orchestrated stuff. The European Union is very, very committed to it. The same European Union is wanting to build its own European army. And they have lots of measures to control people in the name of saving the planet. And, of course, the Agenda 21 stuff and the reducing size of dwellings in cities and shoving more people in cities and increasing rent is another way of control and making more profits for the supranationals. I mean, they basically make vast amounts of money by two routes. One is the overpricing of energy, and the other is the overpricing of housing. You know, the people at the top of this pile are doing very, 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 very well out of the man-made climate change story.
What about these
and
solutions?
The Extinction Rebellion are agents for them, unwittingly, generally speaking.
It's tragic, isn't it, that
so many
folks, I mean, a lot of those youngsters whom, I hate to say youngsters, we're not that old, you and me, but, it sounds patronising.
No, it
sounds patronising to call them youngsters, but they are 20-somethings and, you know, in their late teens, and they parrot this stuff. And they're somehow being brought
up. Yeah,
they
don't have a clue. I talked to some of them, and they don't have a clue.
Yeah, and you said some
of
them are...
Most of them turn away and say, you're a crank, or you're a climate denier. They have this phrase, denier, meaning if you deny something, you must be a Holocaust denier or something. You know. Anyway, it's a term of abuse to call somebody a denier. There's a few of them who will talk and have taken leaflets. Now, they will, in time, some of them, turn against Extinction Rebellion. Now, Greta Thunberg herself is probably is not stupid, but, you know, she is tricked and deluded and brainwashed. Now, it may be that in a year or so's time, she'll see through it all, in which case she'll suddenly become one of the most ardent attackers of globalization. I don't know. It could happen. But you see, we have people in the in our side who were believers in the past and have come to realize how dishonest the whole thing is.
I'm very worried
and
about
something.
They
are very effective.
They're very effective. I'm worried about something that Mark Windows has gotten into quite a bit with you. And
yeah,
I listened to those interviews. Folks, you should check out windowsontheworld.net, by the way, because there's a recent interview.
Yeah.
In fact, it was only a couple of days ago. I think Piers and Mark spent 90 minutes or thereabouts getting into this in great detail. And if you want to really find out more about who Greta Thunberg is and the powers behind her, check out that Windows on the World episode with Piers and Mark Windows.
Yeah.
So rather than us get into that, we'll leave that alone in terms of who she's funded by and all of that. People can check out that episode with yourself.
Well, George
and Mark.
Soros is behind it, of course, somewhere. Not very far behind.
Transforming society, right? Guys like Soros.
That's the one. Open society.
Open society. So he's putting money. He's putting a lot of money into these initiatives.
He is. Yeah, I saw some tweet which showed that. But he's not alone. I mean, the biggest corporations in the world are right into the green story now, because it's to regiment people, control people, and steal their money.
We have listeners here talking about things like geoengineering, and you and I have gotten into that before. If listeners want to hear Piers Corbyn's thoughts on weather manipulation, weather modification, and chemtrails and all of that, just listen to previous conversations that I've had with Piers. He doesn't duck any of these questions or anything like it. Loads of comments coming in, loads of points being made on that. I'm very concerned about the solutions. I'm not so much worried about these stupid solutions like we shouldn't fly anymore or we shouldn't. I'm not concerned about those, but I am concerned about the Internet of Things and all the devices in your house being connected to smart technology. Imagine it, Piers. Imagine in a few years' time, I have to pay more council tax than you because I've been eating more of the wrong type of thing. How does the council know that? Well, my fridge is a smart fridge. These are the things they're proposing.
It's not
even funny, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Smart meters, smart fridges, smart blenders. These are the things I'm more concerned about than morons saying we shouldn't fly anymore. The solutions seem to be straight out of dystopian science fiction novels, don't they?
They do. I agree with you completely, and I'm extremely worried about this total control being handed to, corporate state appendages. The reason for 5G is that is control, and the very worrying thing about it is completely anti-biodiverse. And it's not surprising, therefore, that the Citizens Online operation, which was the start-up for Extinction Rebellion, includes on its board somebody from ExxonMobil and somebody from one of these 5G corporations. I mean, they are there to build this movement in their interest. But the 5G thing itself requires the cutting down of a lot of trees,
you see,
because it depends on line-of-sight communications. And that is, you know, completely counter to anything the Green Movement is talking about. However, I haven't heard a peep from Extinction Rebellion against 5G.
No.
I haven't heard a peep from them against wind farms.
It's insane.
And wind farms in Germany last year killed over 1,000 tons of insects, a lot of these being pollinating insects. So this causes crop losses. And, you know, as we're moving into a colder climate, in fact, because of lower solar activity, this is going to be a very serious matter.
Piers Corbyn is our guest, weatheraction.com. A couple of points I want to make there. Massive interest in this on Twitter, on social media there. Are you, as an academic and as a proponent of free speech, are you very concerned about recent announcements by the UK government that they want people saying things deemed to be fake news to be erased from social media? They use the vaccine example. But why not in a year's time? Mm-hmm. Why not in a year's time? Why not decide that Piers Corbyn is harmful because his theories are wrong let's get him off social media. This is no joke. Does that concern you, that?
Well, it does concern me, and I think it is very largely. Control is the word now from on high. And you see, if I was in a university, I would have lost my job by now.
You'd be gone, yeah.
I've taught in universities, of course, but I mean, that was at times when this issue wasn't such a burning thing. Recently, a professor, Peter Pidd, I think his surname is Pidd anyway, in New Zealand, Queensland, Australia, he'd been sacked for speaking out the truth about climate and saying the coral reef is not suffering from man-made climate change in any way whatsoever. And he got the sack. And he recently got reinstated. And the judge completely denounced the academic process and the university which had sacked him, which I think is interesting and a step forward. But you see, there's thousands of academics, hundreds of thousands of academics around the world who are scared of speaking out because they might not be sacked, but they won't be promoted, you know, and so forth. There is a dead hand of suppression against freedom of expression in academia.
And since we last spoke, the BBC sent a memo to all of its production staff to say that the argument on climate change has been settled. I know you know this.
I do know. Well, yeah. Our letter to them, which is on our website, if you go there, or you go to Piers_Corbyn, Twitter, Piers_Corbyn, and it's the fixed tweet at the top of all my tweets. Piers_Corbyn. There's a letter there we sent to the BBC. It asks for two things. One is provide balance on this issue, and two, provide peer-reviewed, evidence-based science papers or a paper which shows that CO2 controls climate, using data over the last 100 years, 1,000 years or million years, whatever, but using real world data.
They can't do it. Who's
no,
to
they
say?
Can't do it, but we should keep on hammering them.
Keep on hammering them.
We should
hammer
all others as well. You know, I mean, none of them have come forward. They've all waffled. The BBC, to be kind of fair, in the form of Roger Harabin, did respond when we asked about six months ago and said he would send me something. But he didn't. I phoned him up and texted him back, and he just refused. So he seems to have imagined he had something, but then somebody pointed out to him probably that it wasn't any good. So he didn't send anything.
So he sent you nothing?
He sent us nothing at all.
Yeah.
But at least he responded. All the rest didn't respond at all.
No, which is disgusting. Listeners,
but he's an arts graduate, you see, so he knows nothing of science, but just thought that he knew where to get it,
and he couldn't.
And he looked and he found he couldn't. There was nothing there.
We're getting a lot of tweets. By the way, as Piers just mentioned, it is at Piers_Corbyn on Twitter. Follow Piers on there.
Yes, at Piers_Corbyn.
_Corbyn. Yeah. Lot of questions coming in here from listeners and comments saying, how can we be sure that those pushing this CO2 drives climate hoax, which I think it is, how can we be sure that they are not sometimes accelerating existing weather patterns, or that they're not behind anomalous wildfires in places like the Moors here in the Northwest, or places like California? Now, I know you, as an academic, as a teacher, I know that you're not going to be, you know, you try as best as you can to deal in facts. But a lot of our listeners say, well, who benefits most when there's a very unusual weather event? Surely those who benefit most are those who want to push this agenda. How can we be sure that something like that is not behind accelerating storms and stuff?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question, and that sometimes there are things which are improper going on. I mean, quite a proportion of wildfires are started by people deliberately, sometimes in the fire service, who wanted to become heroes, and there are reported cases of this. But you're right, the reportage of these things is often hysterical, and I wouldn't put it past newspapers even assisting others to do it. But I haven't any evidence of that. This is just a suggestion, but there has been evidence of wildfires being deliberately started by people in the fire service in America. Now, the other thing is about extremes. Every time we have a so-called extreme, they trumpet it, if it's warm, that is. They don't trumpet it if it's cold. And they say it's man-made climate change. But there's a increasing selectivity of data. Like this warm February, for example, this so-called record in Wales was at a station which with a very short data set, which had obviously been deliberately chosen as being a new station in a place where it would get hot. And the previous holders of the records which were in North Wales didn't show any special heat or certainly didn't break a record at the time of this short data set one did. So it was selected out to this purpose. And the hottest one in that period was in Kew Gardens. Now, Kew Gardens, you see, is now in a city, whereas all the parts of the Kew Gardens record, of course, are when it was colder. So not surprisingly, it's warmer now. Furthermore, the river levels have gone down because of drinking water and dredging and so forth. So it isn't so much cooling anymore by the River Thames.
Yeah.
So, it's not a fair thing to announce a record from Kew Gardens. But, of course, they do, and they will carry on doing this. Basically, there is a huge amount of fraud going on, and I repeat the word fraud, in world temperature data. The satellite data is more accurate, but I think that is also not immune from fraud, or if it is at present, it won't be for long.
Piers, I know you've got to get to Kensington. I know you've got an event on there.
Yes, in the Science Museum, a bit of fun there we're going to have a look at.
Well, you better jump on the tube then.
One of your former colleagues in your previous media activity, Sharon, is involved in that, and she said best wishes to your operation.
Yeah, Sharon is a great lady. Yeah, she worked at TPV in production. She was a fabulous woman. Yeah. Well, give her our best, Piers. Folks, go to weatheraction.com. That's weatheraction.com. If you can lend support financially to initiatives like that, Scientists for Truth, you really should do it, because advertisers don't want to come anywhere near guys like us, sadly. So if you want to get the information, you've got to support it as best as you possibly can. Thanks for coming on, Piers. It's been a while. I hope
Thank
it won't
you.
Be as long before you come back, mate.
Excellent. Well, keep it up. You're doing a grand job.
You're a gentleman. Okay. Have a great event this evening. Thanks a lot. That was Piers Corbin, weatheraction.com, a scientist, a meteorologist, lecturer, and former politician. Piers is a genuine socialist, asking questions of those who perpetuate this myth that CO2 is causing catastrophic climate change on the planet. Great to have him back on weatheraction.com there. Right, it is exactly 2.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Big shout out to to Phil Restino, a friend of mine who's listening in Florida today. How you doing, Phil? Thanks for the messages, mate. Ruth, who I mentioned earlier on in Australia, wanted me to mention that it's Anzac Day tomorrow. It is indeed. I wouldn't have known that. I knew it was obviously April, around this time of the year, but I wouldn't have known the exact dates. Cheers for that, Ruth. Oz Little, that's JP, by the way, I think, in Madchester. It is JP, isn't it? Yorkshire used to grow grapes in Roman times. That's right. The Antarctic was mapped in a landmass less than 500 years ago and has fossilised forests. How much do people not know? It's no secret. Or are people too lazy for history? Yes. I don't know. The answer is all of the above. People, we are led to believe that there are more sources available to people than ever. We are constantly told that people have a rainbow. They have a plethora of sources for their news and information. But that's not true. It's not true. They don't. When people say that, they mean that, oh, they've got all these social media sites. No. Those social media sites are controlled by the same people who control your national and your commercial television and radio and your broadsheets and your tabloids. There isn't all of a sudden this greater diversity in the mainstream. So people get their information from the same places. And the same places tell them all the time that the science on Climate Change is settled. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, 1,300 scientists. That is a lie. You know, I briefly, barely challenged Piers there because there's no point in challenging him. It is a lie. They are mostly not scientists. It's a political organisation. You know, and I don't know what more needs to be done to get people to think harder about these issues. People need to think about the solutions. David Icke has always said that, you know. Look at the proposed solution to the catastrophe, whatever it is, whether it's terrorism, whether it's a huge economic shock, massive financial collapse. Wasn't it interesting, by the way, that Piers Corbyn said the last time we had this sort of hysteria around climate change was before the fabled crash of 2008, which was, of course, a planned and manipulated crash which drove more and more and more assets, more national assets, more real wealth upstairs to the global financial elites, of course. And he said, watch out for another coming collapse. I know my great friend and colleague in Cleggan in Ireland, Jean-Anne Crowley, is very, very interested in financial crashes. And there are people connected to this program who believe that another very serious financial shock is on the horizon. There is no choice in the media. And there's little or no choice in terms of what people are saying in the so-called independent media either. You know, I know you don't like me saying that, but tough shit, Paddy. It's the truth. Hi to Paddy Mick. Hi to Patricia. Hi to David. Hi to Dean Smith, by the way. And I'm going to take a musical interlude right now. And when we come back from that, more comments. Yes, G. Edward Griffin will be on the programme. I'm really looking forward to that. We're going to be talking about the Red Pill Expo briefly, give you information on that. And we're then going to be talking about, I've got a really interesting question for G. Edward Griffin, who spent decades and decades trying to alert people to things like very salient, very important questions like, who controls the global purse strings? How did they get to do that? What is money? What is banking? And we'll get into some of that. We'll have a bit of a broad chat with Ed when he joins the programme in a couple of minutes' time. All right. Before that, then, it's Caro Emerald on Your Richie Allen Show. Good to be with you this Wednesday. Music from Caro Emerald there. The song's called On a Night Like This. It's the Richie Allen Show live in Manchester. 5 minutes past six it is on Wednesday, April 24th, 2019. It is chucking it down, cats and dogs here in South Manchester. The city gearing up for the derby, United versus City, 8 o'clock later on. A lot of comments on Twitter there about Piers Corbyn. To follow what people are telling me on Twitter, go to twitter.com and where it says search Twitter, just put Richie Allen Show in all one word. It's been a couple of years, I think, since my next guest was on this programme. He's a genius, and it's a word I certainly don't use lightly. He is a verifiable genius, a brilliant man, and thoroughly approachable with it as well. He is, of course, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve, and also the seminal World Without Cancer. He's done a lot, so I won't get into too much of his resume. He's also the chairman of the Red Pill Expo, and I want to talk a little bit about that. It's having its third year, its third event this year. We'll find out more about it. And of course, he founded Freedom Force International, and a lot of great authors and writers owe a great debt of gratitude to him, because without him, they wouldn't have been able to publish. Let's welcome back to the programme the great G. Edward Griffin. Ed, welcome back to the Richie Allen Show. How are you?
I'm doing great, Richie. The great Richie Allen, I might say.
Not at all. I'm absolutely cowed by your brilliance. You know, one of my greatest friends in the media was Jim Mars, rest in peace. And Jim would come on this programme and would never fail to name his sources. a proper journalist, and we would talk about a book that he wrote called A $1 trillion Conspiracy. And Jim would say, Richie, the creature from Jekyll Island. And your name would often come up, Ed. So I'm delighted you're back on the programme. There's been about 500 tweets, by the way, about you coming on with questions about the cashless society and banking, and we can talk about that. But I'm fascinated by the Red Pill Expo, which has been a huge success, and in the next few weeks it's having its third event. Tell us about it, Ed. What is it, and where can people find out more about it?
Well, thanks for that lead-in. Yes, it's very much on my mind. It's preoccupying just about every hour of my waking day and some of my sleeping as well. But yeah, the Red Pill Expo is a most amazing phenomenon. I guess most of your listeners probably are quite familiar with the meme, take the red pill, wake up, see life the way it really is. You know, it's sort of like you drink your coffee now and wake up, man. Things are happening. Don't let it slip by you. Well, that's it all comes from that sci-fi movie, which is now 20 years old, I understand, called The Matrix. So I don't need to go into that, except that the whole idea is to realize that a lot of things that we think we know, especially those things that are most important to us, I mean, things that relate to our lives in a profound way, things like our money, like our government, like our educational system, like our healthcare system and so forth. You know, we have been taught from cradle on up that to trust authority, and that everything is fine. Everything's being taken care of by somebody who has great wisdom and who has the authority to look out for us. And it's a comforting thought. And in some cases, it's actually true. But in many cases, it's quite the opposite, that the people we find out later, I found this out many times in my life, I find out that the very people that I thought had my best interests in mind, in their authorities, of course, actually didn't have that at all. They had their own personal agendas or agendas of organizations to which they belong. And I was merely the patsy. So anyway, the idea is that we bring together all of the experts we could find in their respective fields who have taken some red pills of their own. And I can guarantee you that once you've taken a red pill, you don't want to keep it to yourself. You're overwhelmed with a little bit of amazement, a little bit of anger. And if you're like me, you have a crusader gene that kicks in and you want to do something about it. You want to change this. So you start talking about it. And so there are a lot of people out there that want to tell about what they've learned on the journey of life and to help us avoid making the same mistakes that they did and avoid coming to the same false conclusions that they did. And some of them are really experts in their field. They're top-notch physicians, they're politicians or former politicians, they're people who've been there in the trenches. And so we bring them to the Red Pill Expo and we call them the faculty. And that's just about the summary of it. And a lot of people who we like to think of ourselves as being truth seekers, we come to the Red Pill Expo because we know that, you know, if we call ourselves a truth seeker and we really believe that, and we do, that means that we have to admit we don't know everything by far. And a person who says, oh, I've been there, I've done that, I know about this, this is bunk or whatever, they're not really a truth seeker, they're a truth judger. And by the way, I'm not against that entirely, because I do know that, you know, if you've traveled around the sun as many times as I have, you can't help but come to the conclusion that you do know a couple of things, or you've discovered a few things. But that doesn't mean you close your mind to alternative views, because even at my incredibly advanced age, you've discovered that, oh my gosh, as smart and as old as let me put it backwards, as old and as smart as I thought I was pretty stupid on this one still. So anyway, that's what the Red Pill Expo is, Richie, and people come from all over the world. We're quite amazed and pleased at that, because we're trying to build a coalition of truth seekers, a coalition of people who've learned how to question authority and how not to just take everything at face value. We'd like to build a movement, actually, that can change some of these parameters, that can bring about true reform in banking and in money and in healthcare and certainly in politics. So that's what it's all about. And of course, there's a lot more to be said about it. But anybody who would like to either come to the event, and by the way, we always have people coming from the UK that can come over here to the US. One of these days, we hope we can have one of our events right there in the UK or somewhere you know, across the pond, as we say.
Lovely.
And so we're looking forward to that day, too. But if we know that most people cannot come. And so if you come to the website, you'll see a way that you can see and watch the whole event on your computer or on your TV. And if you're a student at Red Pill University, which is very low cost, I mean, it's almost ridiculous, you can watch it entirely free. So that's what it's all about.
That's brilliant, Ed. What struck me about it, reading it, you know, I get asked to promote various conferences and things, and most of the time I'm very reluctant. What you're doing is very, very different, because you've inspired me in the way that you understand that, I think anyway, that you understand better than anybody I've met, that to get to people, to get people's attention, you've got to introduce them to all those various academics and all those various physicians who have swallowed the red pill, because they are more likely maybe to listen to those people. And that's very inspirational, very worthwhile to do that. I try to do it on the show, get some mainstream politicians on and some mainstream doctors who have seen a little bit behind the screen, who've seen behind the dark cloth or behind the curtain. And it's brilliant because people are more likely to listen to them than they are maybe to listen to somebody, you know, maybe who doesn't come from mainstream society. Have I said that right? I think I have. I think...
yes, yeah. Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with that. We can't know everything. So naturally, I remember when I was a lot younger than I am now, I always thought that the only difference between, old people and young people, let's start with that, was that the old people were unlucky. And the young people were lucky. That was the first. I thought, oh, I'm lucky. I'm a young one. I'll never get old. I never thought about really. Oh, I knew intellectually, but in my heart, I never thought I would get old. It was those unfortunate people that got old, and that won't happen to me. And then as I got a little older, I thought, oh, okay, well, this process is going on even with me. Then I started to think, well, those people who are sick, oh, they're the unlucky ones. I'm glad I'm lucky. I'm not sick, and I'll always be healthy. So, you know, we wake up as we go along that, oh, my gosh, not everything is what we – I'm getting off track. But you said it right. You said it absolutely right. We just have to we look to authority. I guess that's what I've tried to say.
Yeah, and engage with the mainstream.
Yeah, I know now where I was going now with that. Especially when it comes to health, I used to think that, well, if I ever was unfortunate enough and accidentally became ill, well, then all I got to do is just go to the directory and find a doctor.
Yeah,
I'll just find some doctor who's been trained and I'll hire him to fix me. I never thought it was my responsibility to take an interest and do maintenance on my own body to make sure it didn't break down. And if I became ill, I never dreamed that these guys who have the diplomas on the wall and carry the stethoscopes around their neck, that maybe they don't know everything about what's wrong with me after all. Maybe they're even victims of a system which has captured the educational component of the healthcare field, and doctors and nurses are being trained to carry out a hidden agenda that's not necessarily my health and my best interest. I never dreamed of that, you see.
No.
So that's what it's all about.
Did you, just on that briefly, on the subject of health briefly before I put some, there's been some lovely comments have come in already on Twitter. I want to read some of those for you. There's some really interesting questions. Before that, though, isn't it becoming more evident to people now to be careful about giving blind trust to authority? Isn't it fascinating that you see things in New York State, where a town in New York State says that there's a curfew for children who have not been vaccinated, Ed, that they'll be rounded up and stuff like that? I think sometimes, you know, the emperor can really be caught with his trousers down. I think in an incident like that, the establishment really exposes itself for what it really is. By doing something so disgusting as that, you know, if we find that you're not vaccinated, you're going to be banned from coming into the town centre. Those sorts of stories, while they can look very awful, they're actually quite helpful in helping to kind of wake people up to what's happening.
Absolutely. It's always easier to warn people and get them to listen about a pending disaster when you're very close to it.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're far away and they require a little imagination, it's hard. So, yeah, as things get worse and more drastic, it's a lot easier for people to see it. So that's a good and a bad thing. It means that we're getting very close to the finish line, and it makes it very exciting. But it also charges one up with the feeling of great responsibility to get out there and make things happen quickly, because if we don't change things around fairly soon, we may pass the point of no return. It's a grim thought, but that's one of the things that motivates me to realize that not only are we in a period of great crisis at a lot of levels, but it's also a wonderful thing because it gives us an opportunity to reach out to our fellow travelers on this planet and say, come on, guys, let's all grab an oar now and let's steer the ship around and make it go in a different direction.
Brilliant.
And they're listening and they're grabbing oars. So, yeah, it's very exciting time.
Very exciting time. Redpillexpo.org is the website, by the way. Redpillexpo.org. Get on there. I've just tweeted a link out to it. Some fascinating questions coming in for you, Ed. One of them is a friend of mine who's read your books said to me this morning, said, Richie, ask Ed. Ed makes this very public, by the way. Ed is an octogenarian. He's been around the sun a few times, as he said himself, so I'm not doing him a disservice by saying that. I was asked to put to you, if you could click your fingers this evening, today, and make everybody in the world understand one fact, one irrefutable truth, what would it be? What a question.
That is what a question, yeah. How many days do I have?
I know. One thing, though. If you just had one thing that people would understand, what would it be? I couldn't even begin to think. But I'm fascinated by what you're going to tell me.
Well, so am I. There are different ways to answer that, but the one that pops up in my mind right now happens to be one of my longest-running crusades, and that is for people to understand that the secret for living in tranquility with our fellow human beings who may have different views on many things, the secret is to avoid using coercion against each other, except in a defensive mode. And it doesn't sound like that means very much, but the whole purpose of the study of the state or the government, civics, as they sometimes call it in school, is a discussion of the question, at what point is it legitimate for human beings to use coercion against each other? And because that's what the state is. The state, or the government, if we want to call it that, is merely the legalized use of force. We all get together at some point in a way we say, okay, we're going to authorize some of us in this society to carry weapons, and we're going to put badges on their chests, and we're going to say, we approve of this person with this badge to carry a gun and to shoot other people if necessary, and even kill them, to put them in prison, and all of these things. We're going to authorize some people to use that coercive force against us. And then sometimes people don't go to the next step and say, oh, yes, and by the way, we have to be very careful in limiting these people as to under what conditions they can do that. They just said, well, we got to have the police and we have to have armies, right? And so, okay, we got our police and our armies, and so now we can go back to sleep. No, because then the police and the armies that we hired to protect us over time become the predators, and those are the very people we have to protect ourselves against. So the thing that comes to mind in answer to your question is this rule, this idea that I call the idea X. What is the formula? What is the ideology that we use when we authorize people to use legally use coercion against us? And the answer to that, in my view, is that we have to say that the only reason that the state, the only thing that state can do with its powers is because it gets its power from the people. We like to think that. That's the system we want, is that the state derives its powers from the people. Okay, everybody believes that. So then, all right, the question is, well, what do the people have a right to use coercion for? What right do I have to use physical force against you, or even to cause your death? Well, The first answer is, well, you don't. Well, that's not quite true. We can use force, violence, to protect ourselves against others in a defensive mode. If someone's trying to kill me, I don't think very many people would criticize me for doing everything in my power to defend my life. And then we say, okay, you could use coercion against another person to defend your life. What else? Well, how about my liberty? I don't want anybody to kill me, but I don't want them to come in and enslave me either. Oh, okay, there's another one. You could use coercion to defend your life and your liberty. Anything else? Well, now we come to this third thing, which is my property. Well, what is property? And that gets a little deep if you want to go into it. But your property merely means the things that you need to defend yourself. That's really an extension of defending your life and your liberty. That's your property. You need tools to do that. You may even need weapons. You can't defend your life if you don't have food, if you don't have shelter, if you don't have clothing. All of the things that we call property that are really of importance are those things we need for our life and our liberty. So, okay, property is an extension of life and liberty. And so, therefore, there's a third thing we could use coercion for, is to defend our property as well. And that's where the list ends. And once we understand that those are the only things that you and I can use coercion against our neighbors for, that those are the only things we can delegate to the state, because those are our powers. We can't use coercion against our neighbor to force him to close his shop on Sunday, for example, or to wear seat belts, another example. We could argue that he should. We could persuade him if we can. We could showing by good example that he should. But we don't have the power to beat him up or throw him in prison or take his life if he doesn't do it. So if we can't do that, we can't delegate it to our politicians and say, okay, we can't do this, but we're authorizing you to do it. So therefore, we come to this amazing formula that I've discovered years ago, that the proper function of the state, meaning the proper function of coercion, is limited to the defense of life, liberty, and property, and nothing more. That's where it ends. That's where the state's power ends. It's defensive, it's negative, it's not creative, it's totally negative. I think that's the most important thing. If I could snap my fingers, as you say, and have everyone understand something, if they would understand that principle, I think the world would be an amazingly wonderful place in which to live.
You could unite the world on that general understanding, couldn't you? If everybody was alive to that. Ooh. All of a sudden. And it isn't a difficult concept to grasp. This is the thing, you know, even for a leery, loud Irishman like myself, I understand what you're saying. It's fascinating, this, it really is. Because some of our listeners might have said, oh, Ed would give people the understanding of where money comes from, where money is created. But based on what you said, you wouldn't need to do that. It's really, really interesting that. It really is.
Yes, because all the problems with money come under the heading of coercion.
Yeah.
The state forces us against pain of imprisonment. If we don't accept a certain kind of money, whether we want to or not, they're going to force us to do it by law. And so there again, it's this element of coercion.
G. Edward Griffin is our guest this hour, folks. RedPillExpo.org. Check it out. The third annual Red Pill Expo taking place next month. Ed, I think that's right. And it is sure to be brilliantly attended. But there is a way to watch it online. And maybe in the near future, there'll be a similar event here in the UK. I certainly know people from academia who have woken up and are useful in the assistance of people to maybe look. I mean, I love using academic people and what I call kind of mainstream people as a way to show people that, look, things are not right and we need to take a second look at various subjects. Loads of questions have come in for you, so I'm going to put one or two of them to you. People are very concerned about the rollout of technology, Ed, not just in terms of what technology will mean for people losing their ability to earn a living. We could spend some time talking on that. But people are also very worried about technology as a means to control people. Smart technology being rolled out, 5G, for example, the Internet of Things, everything being connected to the Internet, surveillance and all the rest of it. And a question that's come up all day long for you, when I announced you were coming on earlier on, people said to ask Ed, how close does he think we are to a cashless society where we won't have cash in our wallets and in our purses and in our bags, and how dangerous is that for people, for humanity? Cashless society, Ed, I'm sure there'll be people speaking about that and have been speaking about that at the Red Pill Expo. How concerned are you about that?
Well, I'm very concerned about it, Richie, and I share that concern that your listeners have. And maybe I'm even more concerned because I've maybe been exposed to it a little longer, and I've talked to the experts, and boy, they scare me to death when they tell me about something new I didn't know about this. This is evil, pure evil from top to bottom. And the cashless society, of course, is all part of this using technology to control human beings, which as our technology advances and we have all these wonderful things, all these nice devices and all the artificial intelligence that's coming online now, we look at it on the surface and say, oh, isn't this wonderful? We can get all the answers to our questions. We can download our videos so much faster. And oh, and then more colors in our video picture, and the sound is better, and we can communicate so much faster. And we think of all these benefits, but they're not really anxious for us to know about the underside of that. And that's the red pill. That's another great red pill, by the way, which we will be discussing at length at the Red Pill Expo. And we'll continue to do it from here on out because the issue is going to get more and more important. The cashless society is merely part of that control mechanism using technology. And in a way, we're living in a cashless society now, in the sense that most of transactions are done by credit card or debit cards, and money never comes into really physical existence except as electromagnetic impulses in a computer somewhere. And these little digits fly around our computer screens and around our computer chips, and we never see it. We can't stick it in our pockets, but as long as we can go out and buy a loaf of bread with it, nobody questions it. But the fact is that the evolution is moving, even as we speak, away from credit cards and debit cards. With the current system, even though it is true to say that it's primarily digital money, we can still convert it, if we want to $10 bills and $20 bills here in the States, or whatever your favorite pound note is over there. You can convert it to silver and to gold, and you can convert it into paper currency, and you can stick it in your mattress. You can put it in a coffee can and bury it in your backyard. And you have money that you can possess personally. And even if somebody doesn't like you in the government, if they think you're politically incorrect, they don't like you exposing corruption at the highest levels. They want to call you a conspiracy theorist or something like that. You have independence. They can't do much to you. I mean, you're not threatening their lives or liberty or their property. And so therefore, you should be free to say whatever you wish, even if it weren't true, which in this case it is true. But even if it weren't true, people should have a right, the freedom to be wrong on something without going to prison over it. And so anyway, the point is that as long as you have money in your pocket or hidden somewhere, you have independence. You can still eat. You can still go out and buy things with this cash. But if that were to disappear, and that's what they want that to happen, so that you can't even, you can't have paper money, there will be no coins, then everything is dependent now on that electronic transfer. Even buying a stick of gum, you cannot buy groceries, you cannot pay your rent, you cannot buy an airplane ticket, you cannot get on the bus, you can't do anything without having access to your account, so to speak. And whoever controls that system controls you in a manner that has never been seen before in history. And that's what they want. They want to make sure that people like us, who may be critical of the powers that be, the authorities, if we are embarrassing them in any way, we're pointing out some things that we think they should not be doing, or whatever criticism we may have. They may just say they're going to turn us off, and they'll throw the switch and our account will suddenly be frozen and we won't be able to buy or sell anything.
You're finished.
And that means we'll suddenly become totally dependent on others. We'll be like beggars on the street. And there's nothing more powerful control over a human being than controlling their economic existence. That's where we're headed in a cashless society. And I'm sorry to say that that's where the cryptocurrency field is leading to. We were told, here's another red pill coming up. We were told in the beginning, oh my gosh, Bitcoin is the salvation to freedom. We're going to break free of the banks, right? We're going to ledgers that are diversified, they're distributed ledgers, and nobody will be even to know who we are. And we can make transactions that nobody will know about, and it's wonderful. And besides that, look at all the money we can make if we're early adopters. So we got this idea that somehow the cryptocurrency was going to be our last best hope against this beast system. We're going to be independent and free and rich and all this stuff. Well, it turns out that's not the case at all. As a matter of fact, the very banks and institutions that we're complaining about were on top of this long before we even heard about cryptocurrencies. They were involved. They knew it was coming. They thought they would be in the lead, but they didn't want anybody to know about it. So they promoted it as a means of opposing themselves, much the way the founders of the Federal Reserve did in the early days back in 1910 through 1913. The banks who were creating the Federal Reserve created the illusion. They told everybody, oh, we hate the Federal Reserve. This is not good for the economy. This is not going to be good for America. Meanwhile, they were the ones promoting it in the background. We find a similar thing going now with cryptocurrency, because they see cryptocurrency as the ultimate weapon, the ultimate mechanism for them to have a cashless society.
Yeah.
And the idea that they cannot, under any circumstances, find out who we are or interfere with our transactions or know what we bought and what we sold or where we are, to think that this system that they're creating can prevent that knowledge from being known is very, very naive, to say the least. So back to the cashless society. That's if you don't have money in the bank that you can take out and put in your mattress, then you're trapped into a totally digital system. And from that point forward, they don't even have to get you to pay your taxes, because all they have to do is go in and take the money out of your account before you get it. It's not for you get it first and then pay the government or whoever you have to pay bank interest to the banks or whatever you have to pay. It's not that you get the money first and then you pay it to somebody else. No, they get it first and you get what's left over if you're a good boy and girl and do exactly as you're told.
As you're told. You and I were speaking a couple of years ago when they were stealing money from people in Cyprus. Do you remember the bail-ins, the European Union, the European Central Bank, taking money directly out of people's accounts? G. Edward Griffin, a genius, he is a genius. Ed won't mind me saying that. The Creature from Jekyll Island is one of those, you must read it in your lifetime books, it really is. I can't recommend that highly enough. Mentioned Jim Mars earlier on, Jim swore by Ed's book. It's a fantastic book. And touching on the subjects we're touching on now, you know, sometimes silence is deafening. We often hear politicians in the UK and in the United States, sometimes they'll criticise China for some reason or another. They'll say, oh, the Chinese, they're terrible hackers, they're spies, and they don't treat their people very well. It isn't a very open society. Do you know what? Not a single politician in the United Kingdom or in Ireland or in the United States has criticised this horrendous, new, terrifying system, this social credit system that has been unveiled in China, where people who are deemed to be not very nice or kind of antisocial can be prevented from flying, can be prevented from using their credit card or their debit card. And that terrifies the bejesus out of me, Ed, and I'm not trying to make light of that, because I can see where a totalitarian government in Europe, you know, if the European Union goes the way it wants to go, because it wants to be in, Brussels wants total control and a death to sovereign states in Europe, I can see a day when we'll have a similar system here, where somebody who's been deemed to be a bit of a nuisance or a bit of a pain in the backside, antisocial, we can't jail them, but we can, as you so brilliantly put it a minute ago, switch them off. We can just turn them off by way of punishing them. Am I being crazy and tinfoil hat wearing there, Ed, or is that a genuine possibility?
No, Richie, I think you've understated the situation, if anything. Yes, it's totally absurd at one point, and it's extremely frightening at the other, because it's real and it's happening. And your observation about the Western politicians and journalists is so true. They're so free to criticize China for doing this, but meanwhile they're doing it themselves. Yeah. They can hardly wait to recreate that same system in the West. Because we're not talking about nationalism anymore. There are, you know, these countries, they all sometimes they put on a good show about being opposed to some other nation. They criticize. They might even go to war, you know, against another nation. But they all believe the same. They're not fighting over ideology. It's not a question of liberty versus coercion and slavery. It's a question of who's going to operate the slavery system, them or us. And it's been that way, by the way, for a long time, even through World War I and World War II. I discovered that much later than I should have. I was doing work on the book for The Creature from Jekyll Island, and I came across the fact that especially during World War II, the United States was, you know, fighting a war against fascism overseas and all that. But I got to reading the private papers of the leaders here in the U.S., President Roosevelt and General Marshall and other, the heads of state, the Secretary of the State, all these people who were making the highest level decisions. And they were praising Mussolini and Hitler's policies of collectivism, the all-powerful state. They were praising it. In other words, they believed ideologically, but they just didn't like it because it was Hitler doing it and Mussolini doing it and not them. So I remember it coming to the realization that we were fighting a war against fascism. And we decided, well, I shouldn't say we, I mean the leaders decided that in order to fight fascism effectively, we had to become fascist.
You know, this is powerful stuff, because anybody who wants to understand how the European Union was born should listen to what you just said there. The European Union was born out of the failure of the global international pharmaceutical and petrochemical cartels to control Europe after the Second World War. And you're touching on that here, Ed. I mean, we got into this, I think, a few years ago as well. But that's exactly what it was. People who couldn't be seen to be supporting the actions of the Fourth Reich, the Third Reich, I should say, and the Nazis, were basically wanted to create a world, or the world that Hitler desired, themselves, but to do it covertly. And that's how, in my experience and what I've learned over the years, this is how we got the European Union. What do you think?
Well, the principles are, you're quite on target, because what are the ideological principles of the European Union, and in fact most of the surviving states in Europe, as well as Asia and Africa and America? You take a look at what the leaders of these countries believe. And it has a name. The ideology is called collectivism. And communism, fascism, Nazism, socialism, all of these isms are merely variations of this underlying philosophy called collectivism. So they're all the same at the fundamental level, but they fight with each other like the Dickens over who's going to be the top dog, who's going to really run this totalitarian world system. They want to be at the top, not the middle management. They want to be at top management. And that's when you realize that that's really the way it is, it's a horrible shock. It's a very large red pill, hard to swallow.
It sure is. G. Edward Griffin, our guest this hour. We've got Ed for another 10 minutes, 15 max. The time is absolutely flying by. Great friend of the programme's, Phil Restino, great anti-war peace activist in Florida, is listening to Ed with great interest. And Phil asks a very salient, very important question. Do we hoard cash reserves, or do we try and convert some of our money? Again, most of our listeners, they just don't have any money. It's why they, sadly, why so many people are turning to the independent media, because they're finding themselves struggling harder and harder. But Phil asks, do we spend some money on precious metals, gold, silver? What do we do, Ed, about this cashless society?
Well, yeah, that's...
it's a tough one, right?
That's where the rubber meets the road, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you do about all of this? Well, I look at it as two stages. There's a short-term strategy and a long-term strategy. The short-term strategy is just to get off the track because the train is coming down. And you can't just stand there watching that headlight get closer and closer and closer. The track I'm referring to is whatever savings you have, whatever wealth you may have been able to put aside over your life, and you're holding it either for your enjoyment or for your survival or both, whatever you have in the form of cash, in that sense, currency, you're in grave danger because its value is being diminished by the minute. Inflation is eating away all sovereign currencies. All money systems are based on fiat. And when you hear the news that says, well, the dollar went up or the pound went down, all of this is nonsense because they're merely measuring against each other. All of these currencies are in free fall. They're all falling. And they say, well, the dollar went up. That meant that the dollar was falling a little slower than some of the other currencies today. But they're all falling. And this business of currencies going up and down and making you feel like there's some kind of free market competition out there is another one of those red pills. All currencies are inflating into nothingness. So anybody that keeps their savings and their wealth in the form of money beyond what they need, you know, just for normal everyday transactions is a fool, because they're throwing their money away. The short-term strategy then is to get off of the track. The train is coming. If you get your money out of national currencies and put it into something other than money, which would be something of tangible value. Gold and silver is one of those things. They're my favorite because they've been around for so many centuries and been time-tested by many cultures and many political systems, that it always seems to survive. I like that track record. But there are other things. You can buy inventories. I mean, if you're in business and you're making a widget, well, you might make a few more widgets and put them in the warehouse. I laughingly say that if you have enough money, you can buy a warehouse full of cheap white wine. There's always a market for that.
There always is. That's right.
As long as you get off the track and get your money out of fiat currencies and into something of tangible value that has, you know, that people will still want even after the money disappears. So that's the short-term thing. And I emphasize that because in the long term, that doesn't help you because the systems are still falling. And if we ever go completely to the hit the bottom and we wind up where the whole world, every national system in the world is at the bottom, which means a totalitarian system, all controlled through a cashless society, all controlled through Internet of Things, all controlled with brain waves coming out of your Wi-Fi transmitters and so forth. There's no return from that. So I would say, when you start to think in terms of what can you do about this, you better allocate at least half of your resources, both in money and in mental energy and physical energy and time, into helping to recover the system and bring about change. Because if we don't do that, in the long run, it won't make any difference. And certainly it won't for our kids and our grandkids.
Great friend of mine, the actress Jean-Anne Crowley, great actress, great Irish lady, is listening to this with great interest. She says, buy silver, the poor man's gold. She says, the COMEX has deliberately been keeping the price of precious metals down whilst buying precious metals up themselves. They are devious, these financial institutions. And that leads us to, listeners are asking about financial crashes. Just before you came on, the meteorologist Piers Corbyn was my guest. He's a famous skeptic of climate change, and he had a very good conversation with me in the first hour about why man-made climate change or CO2 driven climate change is a hoax, and he explained why he believes that. But he also said something very interesting. He said the last time that there was this much hysteria about climate change, and we're seeing a lot of hysteria in the UK at the moment about it, but he said the last time was during the lead-in to the manufactured financial crash of 2008. And listeners who do watch their money and who are worried about it are asking me about financial crashes. Is that one of the favourite things of the cabal, of the hidden hand? Is the financial crash one of their favourite tools to bring about, you know, a situation where they can take more real wealth from people, take back houses, take land? Do you worry about that? Is another crash imminent, do you think, Ed?
Well, yeah, I think another crash is imminent, even if there were no motive behind it, because there are cycles that we know historically exist. And you may disagree whether or not there was a motive behind it, but that doesn't change the fact that there are economic cycles that exist throughout history. And
yeah,
and they're pretty regular. And so, yeah, there's definitely going to be another huge, I believe, huge, what we would call a crash. And the wheels are coming off. There's too much debt. There's not enough production. There's too much leverage. It's all smoke and mirrors. There's no productivity. The productivity is going down. The money supply is going up. The standard of living is being sustained through debt. And of course, that's a time bomb. Debt is a time bomb. It has to go off. It's just a question of when. And so, yeah, there's going to be another huge adjustment economically. I just don't know when. But your question is it part of the plan or not? I think it is. You can't prove it unless you are physically present at these meetings. I don't think these meetings take place in a basement with a bare light bulb or anything like that. They probably take place at the finest resorts in the world. And, the G5 conferences, the G7, Bilderbergers, and this Council on Foreign Relations were all where the real power resides. I would love to be in those groups sometime, but I have a pretty good idea of what they're talking about. And my answer to your question is yes, I think that it is a favorite tool of the cabal, that's a great name for it, by the way. To cap it off, I sometimes say to myself, if I were these people, if I had their mindset and their goals and their ethics, what would I do? And it's pretty clear. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
Because it would certainly serve my purposes if I had that mindset. So why wouldn't they?
The aforementioned Jean Ann, who's in Cleggan on the west coast of Ireland, one of the most beautiful places in the world, she often says that Jean Ann has publicly stated her age, and it's there for anybody to see anyway because she's a famous actress, as he approaches 70. She says she would now be better at doing the job of the cabal than the cabal is itself. And with decades of experience yourself, Ed, you could probably do a quicker job of bringing down the whole house of cards than the cabal could itself, you know, kind of ironically. What in the decades that, and I'm not trying to, you know, overemphasize your age at all, I'm not being disrespectful at all here, but in the years that you've been writing and talking around the world, broadcasting, making terrific films, have you seen an elevation in consciousness? I want to ask that. I became aware of things when I read a book about September the 11th in 2003, I think, and I came up in commercial media. I'm a mainstream journalist. That was when I began to realise that things were very, very badly wrong. You knew about things far, far, far earlier than I did, and far longer, even if we were of similar age. Have you seen, in the time you've been researching, writing and speaking, an elevation in consciousness? That would be a positive thing if indeed the answer is yes. Have you?
Yeah, well, the answer is yes, I have. But there's also a negative part to that. There's, first of all, I've been seeing this ever since, well, you mentioned my age. Okay, I'm 87 now. And my crusade began in 1960. That's when I took my first red pill. And by 1961, I was in full gallop. And so I've been on, mentally at least, on the war front since 1960, 1961 at the very latest. And from the very beginning, I have had that question asked. And I myself have asked it in the early days. And in all along the path, I and others who have had, who are traveling a similar path, have always said, yes, there is a rise in the awakening. And I don't think it's our imagination. I think it is true. But that's good. And as I said earlier, the closer you get to the crisis, the easier it is to see that there's a problem. Yeah. I mean, if your town is burning down, the closer the fire gets to your house, the easier it is for you to recognize that, yeah, the town is burning down. So as the fire gets closer and closer to your house, yeah, there's a increased awareness. But that still leaves open the question, so what? What are you doing about it? At the same time, the cabal, I like that name, I'm going to start using it. Yeah. The cabal is aware of this increase in awareness, and they also are increasing their efforts and their momentum. I think everybody recognizes that this is a mad dash for the finish line. And everybody's running faster and faster and faster. And while awareness is increasing, so is the power of the cabal. So is the power of the media. So, and they're reaching quickly as possible to get the Internet of Things in, to get 5G in, to get the cashless society in, to get everybody under forced vaccinations and under some kind of mind control and drug control, because they know time is running out. So it's good and it's bad. But in essence, I think it's good because it means we're living in a time where you and I can actually make a huge difference in the long term that lies ahead. What is going to happen to determine which way the world goes is probably going to be decided in the lifetime of most people living today, and maybe even my lifetime if I can keep going a little bit longer.
I don't think there's any danger if you're not keeping going any longer. I wasn't being disrespectful mentioning the age.
Oh, I don't take it that way at all. In fact, I'm amazed that I am still going. I don't feel this age at all. I don't know how this is happening. I keep expecting the other shoe to fall.
Yeah. You sound like a man half your age or younger. It's been remarked on quite a bit on Twitter. And of course, you've got a Wikipedia page and people can see, even though there are obviously these Wikipedia pages for people like you, they're generally hit pieces. Yours is not too bad, actually, but they can see, you know, just how long you've been on the road. We've got about three and a half minutes left on this. I didn't want to interrupt you. We've got about 3 minutes left. I do want to again give a plug, though, to Red Pill Expo. And the website for it is redpillexpo.org. And if you go onto YouTube and put Red Pill Expo in, you'll see an advertisement for it, and you'll see clips and various bits of the previous Red Pill Expos over the last couple of years. I recommend you support it. It's an extraordinary thing that they're doing, because bringing people from mainstream to talk about these issues is a great way to wake more and more people up to it. And I'm really, really impressed by that. I really am. So I'm going to give you the final word, Ed, and I hope that when the event is over and you take a breather and give yourself a dusting down and relax, because it takes a lot to put an event like that on, I would imagine. I hope that in the summer you might come back and we might do a longer stint. We might have a chat about one or two other aspects of this agenda and of this cabal in the summer. I'd be honoured to have you back on. So I'll give you the final word. All the best to everybody associated with Red Pill Expo, redpillexpo.org. Final word to you, Ed, and thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Richie. I appreciate that. And I don't know what the final word is. I guess there's no final word except, as they said here in the political system a few years ago, just keep on keeping on.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from, but it's a great, that's my final word, I think. But the final thought is that, and I think your listeners are well aware of this, we need to question authority. That doesn't mean we have to become rabble-rousers or anything like that. But most of the problems of the world today are coming from authority. The more we ask governments to do, the more power we give governments to do solve these problems. That means that there's more power and there's more money floating around in that thing called government. And that's a magnet. It's a magnet that attracts the predator class. All the criminals in the world are gravitated to go into government work, because all the money and all the power is there, and they can commit their crimes and they don't go to jail because they're the government, you know. So the problem is authority. And the problem is not just authority, but the fact that we give these authority figures, we give them guns, we give them the blessings to go and use coercion, but we don't tell them where to stop using it. We don't put limits on it. We don't tell them that the only justification for using that authority is to defend us, not to control us, not to direct our lives, not to tell us what to think, but to defend our lives, our liberty, and our property, and nothing more.
Ed, thanks so much for your time today. Redpillexpo.org, folks, check it out. And I'll get in touch with you in the early summer to arrange another time with your permission, Ed. Thanks for your time today. It was marvellous to catch up with you again after such an absence. And all the best in the coming weeks. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Richie. It's my pleasure, and I'm looking forward to a return trip, too.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ed. The marvellous G. Edward Griffin there, redpillexpo.org. Lovely to have him back on the programme. A genius. Again, if you haven't read The Creature from Jekyll Island, you have to read it, and you have to share it with others. It's magnificent. That's about it for the programme. Going to wrap it up right there. Marvellous. Again, thanks, Ed. Again, thanks to Piers Corbin, my guest in the first hour of the show. We'll do it all again tomorrow, Thursday, at the usual time, of course, of 5 p.m. UK time. Until then, look after yourselves and one another. I'm going to go and watch the Manchester Derby now. The mighty Red Devils of Manchester, not so mighty in recent seasons, sadly, are playing the Super Blues of Manchester City in a massive game in the Premier League. Bread and circuses, I know. But you have to take your pleasure where you can find it, right? Right. Look after yourselves. Back with you again tomorrow at 7. Leaving you with Rod Stewart. 5 even. 5. See you tomorrow. Bye.